The title for this conference is Anger and the Love of Enemies. In the Sermon on the Mount, chapter 5 of Matthew's Gospel, beginning with verse 21, we read, "You have heard it said of old, you shall not commit murder, and every murderer shall be liable to judgment. What I say to you is, everyone who grows angry with his brother shall be liable to judgment." Jesus claims that anger is to killing what thought is to the word. We are told then not only to avoid anger ourselves, but to do what we can to remove the anger that others have against us. And that is why, again, reading this same fifth chapter, Jesus says, "If you bring your gift to the altar, and there recall that your brother has anything against you, leave the gift at the altar, and go first and be reconciled with your brother, and then come and offer your gift." This prohibition against anger is an extension of the beatitude, "Blessed are the peacemakers." We are told to seek reconciliation with those who are angry at us. And Jesus tells us that such a task is even more important than offering worship to God. To make this whole thing more vivid, we might imagine if one of us had been chosen to bring up the gifts at the offertory procession at a Sunday liturgy, and if we should follow the teaching of Jesus literally, let's suppose that halfway up the aisle of the church, with a full church of people, we suddenly remember that someone is angry at us. Jesus says that we should drop the gift, we should hold up everything, and go first and be reconciled to that person, at least try to be reconciled, and only then come and offer that gift. Of course, what Jesus is telling us in this very dramatic example is that it is more important that we work at establishing peace with other human beings than it is to offer worship to God. That if, let's say, on a Sunday morning, you had to make a choice between going to Mass and participating in the liturgy of the Eucharist and going to a fellow human being that has something against you, that is angry toward you, according to the teaching of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount, our first obligation is to become reconciled with our fellow human being. Putting it another way, that God will not accept our worship and the gift of ourselves that we offer him until we have done everything we can, leaving no stone unturned, to become reconciled, to make peace with our fellow human beings. Now, Jesus, of course, is talking particularly about what we would call evil or sinful anger. There is certainly a justification for what is called a righteous anger. We can be angry toward evil when evil is considered as a thing, as a deviation from the kingdom of God, as a turning aside from the path which leads to God. Therefore, we can resent the wrong directions, the wrong turns which we see our neighbor taking. We can be very upset about these wrong turns. But all the time, we must continue to love the person who is doing these wrong things. We must learn to distinguish between the person and the action of that person. We have a responsibility to resist the evil actions of others even unto death, never compromising with the evil when we see it, no matter how much we love the person who does it, or no matter how much we want to please that person. But throughout our resistance to the evil of their actions, We must somehow find the strength and grace to continue to love the person who is doing them. We must love them so much that we will try in our minds to find some way of excusing them from their guilt, just as Jesus did from the cross. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they are doing. We must love the evildoer so much that we are willing to go to any extreme, even death itself, even to the extent of dying for them, in order to save them and help them. Jesus tells us that whenever we feel anger within ourselves, we must check to see if our inner souls are poisoned by unconscious hatred, resentment, or fear. There is the possibility, always, that our anger is righteous, but often it is not. And so we must cleanse our house and burn out the evil that is still lurking there. We need to search our feelings to see if there is fear or envy, jealousy, selfishness, greed. We must unearth these forgotten and repressed roots of evil within us, which are usually manifested in our anger. Jesus says we must try to make peace with others, those to whom we feel anger and those who feel anger towards us. If this fails, it is usually because our own inner attitude toward the other is not right. Anger takes possession of us whenever we allow the instinct of self-preservation to get out of control and take precedence over the instinct to love and give ourselves to others. Actually, the instinct of love is a deeper and stronger instinct than that of self-preservation. But the trouble is that we have allowed love to be superseded and covered over by selfishness. We have repressed our instincts to love and over-cultivated the instincts of self-preservation. And so now it is necessary to reverse this process and to force ourselves to love and to practice self-denial of the instinct of self-preservation. But if we are to handle our anger, our first step is to admit it, to acknowledge its presence. Rather than repressing it, we must bring it out in the open and try to purge ourselves of whatever selfishness or fear or hatred or anxiety, rivalry, resentment, bitterness, greed, cruelty, whatever that there is of evil in our own attitude. One way to do this is to think of the grievances others have against us. And one such grievance is our unwillingness to go the extra mile that Jesus says we should, to do more than strict justice demands, to practice mercy and love. So often, we escape responsibility for our faults by putting the spotlight on the faults of others and keeping ourselves distracted from attending to our own faults in some other area, which may be much worse and do greater harm than the particular thing in another that causes our anger. Or at least we may be more accountable before God because of the greater light and grace that we have been given. Much of our anger is caused by our need of self-defense. We feel threatened by others. We see our freedom in danger of being taken away, our rights violated. And so it will help to keep our anger under control if we can convince ourselves of God's almighty power and His loving care. If we are able to return good for evil, to continue to love those who hate us, then it is impossible for others really to harm us. Surely they can cause us suffering, but in the hands of God's loving care, this suffering becomes the instrument to sanctify us and to purify us of our own faults. Judged only in the light of this present life on earth, what others may do against us seems terrible. But when viewed from eternity, let's say from 100 years from now, and if accepted with love, then as long as we try to go out in love to God and others, whatever others do against us will never do us any lasting harm, but only good. This is why Jesus can say so confidently in the Sermon on the Mount, "You have heard the commandment of old, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, offer no resistance to injury. When a person strikes you on the right cheek, turn and offer him the other cheek. If anyone wants to go to law over your shirt, give him your coat as well. Should anyone press you into service for 1 mile, go with him an extra mile. You have heard the commandment, you shall love your neighbor, but hate your enemy. My command to you is love your enemies. Pray for your persecutors. This will prove that you are the children of your heavenly Father, who makes the sun to rise on the bad as well as the good, and to rain on the just as well as the unjust. If you only love those who love you, what merit is there in that? Do not even the tax collectors do as much? If you greet only your brethren, what is so praiseworthy about that? Do not the pagans as much? In a word, you are to be merciful and perfect as your heavenly Father is merciful and perfect." If our dignity is rooted in an authentic relationship with God, a slap in the face will not harm us, nor even upset us unduly. If we are aware of our own inner security, the security that comes from a knowledge of God's love for us and God's loving care, we will not be so inclined to return evil, but only to serve creation. This non-resistance to evil must not be due to fear and cowardice. It must be motivated by a tremendous love for the person who is practicing evil against us. We ask ourselves, what can I do to help this other person? If I merely give back the same kind of anger or hatred or evil that the other person is showing toward me, I will only increase the supply of evil in the world. Whereas if I can return love, then I can counteract something of the evil that may be present in that other person's actions. St. Paul, in the 12th chapter of Romans, talks about how to handle anger. We read, beginning with verse 9, "Your love must be sincere. Detest what is evil, cling to what is good. Love one another with the affection of brothers and sisters. Anticipate each other in showing respect. Do not grow slack, but be fervent in the Spirit. Rejoice in hope and be patient under trial. Bless your persecutors, bless them, and do not curse them. Have the same attitude towards all. Never repay injury with injury. If possible, live peaceably with everyone. Do not avenge yourselves. Leave that to God's wrath, for it is written, 'Vengeance is mine, I will repay.' If your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink. By doing this, you will heap burning coals upon his head. Do not be conquered by evil, but conquer evil with good. Paul is quoting here from the 25th chapter of the book of Proverbs, verse 21. We can think of these burning coals as the fire of charity, which can enkindle a response of love in the other person. Our attitude of loving our enemies and returning good for evil will not always change the evil attitude of the other. Even Jesus was unable to do this as far as his enemies were concerned. But at least we do not add our own evil to the evil of the world. And the suffering that we receive will help to accomplish within ourselves that brokenness, that openness to the Spirit that is so necessary if we ourselves are to grow in wholeness and holiness. When we are the recipients of evil from others, if we can relax and let the attack sweep over us, the suffering we endure will awaken our own inner self and remove our blind spots and enable us to see the deeper meaning of life. And therefore, Jesus tells us to look at such a situation from the standpoint of God. We ask ourselves, why did God allow this enemy to become so powerful and to do us so much harm? In what way can it be for my benefit? What are the blind spots in my own attitude that need to be removed? The outer enemy very often forces us to face our inner enemy. And just as we read in the book of Genesis how Jacob wrestled with the angel of darkness until dawn, and it became the angel of light, the angel of the Lord. And so if we wrestle with this anger, this resentment, this desire to return evil for evil, we will find that it will awaken within us some new insights about our own sinfulness, about our own weakness, about our own faults. And so it can become for us, just as for Jacob, the angel of light. Love of enemies is perhaps the most difficult task that Jesus imposed upon his disciples. But Jesus does not ask us to do something that he himself was unwilling to do. It was love of enemies that Jesus practiced most of all in his passion. We must be willing to go as far as Jesus did to reconcile ourselves with our enemies. That means to pray for them, to forgive them, to lay down our lives for them. We must leave no stone unturned in our efforts to come to terms with our opponent, willing to stoop very low, to humble ourselves, to show the initiative in making peace, to be willing to make the first move, and to keep trying to be reconciled, even though rebuffed again and again, even though our efforts at peacemaking are taken advantage of so that fresh evil is practiced against us. In our efforts at reconciliation, we must continually examine our own consciences to see if there is perhaps some legitimate complaint that this other person has against us. Usually where there is smoke, there is some fire. Not necessarily. Again, in the case of Jesus, we cannot say that his enemies were justified in the opposition that they showed to him. And so it's quite possible in our own situation that we may be perfectly clean and free of guilt or evil. However, in many other instances, there is fault on both sides. And so this love of enemies means that, first of all, we look to our own consciences, perhaps with the help of a spiritual director or a soul friend, and try to discern if there is anything at all of truth in what that other person has against us, and if so, to try to remedy it. This teaching of Jesus regarding love of enemies is not limited merely between one individual and another. The teaching of the gospel on love of enemies is just as applicable when it is a matter of two nations, for example, Russia and the United States, being at enmity with each other. The gospel challenges us as a nation to become reconciled to Russia, to return good for evil, to go out of our way to make peace, to be willing to run the risk of being taken advantage of. This is the teaching of Jesus. As I say, it is perhaps the most difficult teaching that Jesus gives us in the gospel. Perhaps the one teaching that has been least practiced by Christians, either as individuals or as nations, down through these past 20 centuries. But if we are to expect God to forgive us, then we must be willing to forgive one another. We must be willing to go out in love, even to those people who have done us harm in the past, even to those people that are willing and ready to do harm to us now. I think we have two examples of love of enemies in our own time that was practiced, first of all, by Gandhi in India and Martin Luther King Jr. in our country. In both of these persons, there was a tremendous effort to show love for the very people that were persecuting them, for the very people that were real enemies. And it was through this love that Gandhi had for the British, that he had for the Muslims and other people, that he was able to accomplish as much good as he did. Gandhi was once asked, "What about Hitler?" His reply was that if enough love had been shown, even in that instance, that love would have succeeded in overcoming that evil. Be that as it may, we have the very clear and certain teaching of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount, that if we wish to be Christians, if we wish to be disciples and followers of Jesus Christ, then we must practice, both as individuals and as a nation, the same kind of love of enemies that Jesus Christ practiced toward his enemies. In the teaching of Jesus concerning love of enemies, we find ourselves at the very heart of the meaning of that symbol of the cross, which, of course, is the main symbol of Christianity. To understand the symbol of the cross, we need, first of all, to have some knowledge of the symbol of the dragon. Among the ancient people of the Near East, before the coming of Jesus, the dragon was the symbol of evil. The serpent would be simply one form of the dragon, an elongated form. But the dragon as such is not only among the Israelites, but other ancient people of the Near East, constantly represented evil. Now, until Jesus came on earth, the normal way that was used to overcome the evil dragon was to slay the dragon. And so we find that Joshua, for example, in the Old Testament, felt totally under the command of God's will when he went out and slayed all of his enemies. But with the coming of Jesus, he reversed this symbolism. Instead of Jesus slaying the dragon, he allowed the dragon to slay him. The forces of evil that Jesus Christ encountered put him to death on Calvary. And so the cross now symbolizes a new way of handling evil. That we return good for evil. That we return love for hatred. As St. Paul says, be not overcome by evil, but overcome evil by good. And love of enemies practiced at every level, both individual and community. This is what we mean by the cross of Christianity. Unfortunately, Christianity has lost sight of this particular teaching of Jesus that he practiced. We find even people in the highest authority in the church stating that it is legitimate for America to build up its nuclear deterrence, to have the capabilities to destroy the whole human race, to slay the dragon, in other words, wherever it finds evil. This is a return to the Old Testament way of handling the dragon. And just as before the coming of Christ, they never succeeded in conquering evil, because each time that the dragon was slain, in the next generation, the dragon returned to life stronger than ever. And so it is time that we take seriously this new symbol of the cross, that we begin to practice at every level of life the teaching of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount, namely, to overcome hatred and anger and to practice love of enemies even to the extent of laying down our life for our friends as well as for our enemies. This is the end of the conference on anger and love of enemies.